13.
Yeah.
Episode 13. Welcome to episode 13 of Thinking Habits podcast. This week, we're going to be talking about sleep. I knew I was going to do that. I'm such a contagious yawner. If anybody even mentions the word yawn, I will yawn.
We'll stop it, because otherwise we'll just be back and forth yawning.
Yeah. Pam's here.
Hello.
But before we get into the sleep bit, there's a couple of bits of news that were quite interesting. Yesterday, there was loads of sport on yesterday. But in particular, what struck me was the boxing, because there was an interview in BBC News with Luke Jackson, who was fighting and ultimately lost to Carl Frampton, spoiler alert. But the thing that was interesting about that interview was about his very candid discussion about his struggle with OCD. Just reading a bit of the interview here, it says, "I have mental health issues," he candidly tells BBC Sport. "I've lived with a condition for 28 years of my life and I didn't understand it. OCD, people think, is just touching stuff or washing your hands. Since I started seeing someone, I understand it." The Australian, 33, has faced suicidal thoughts. At one point, began the habit of driving certain stretches of road with his eyes closed, and says that he even pointed a loaded crossbow down his own throat. The form of OCD he has triggers negative thoughts. One way it manifests itself during a fight is that he has to touch the ropes with both hands every round, he says, to ward off forces and negative thoughts. That's really interesting, because obviously in episode 2 I talked about intrusive thoughts, and you don't often hear people talk openly in the media about intrusive thoughts, because it's still not as widely understood as I would like it to be, I'll be honest. I mean, you do see a lot of there's a lot of obsessive behaviour in sport. There's a lot of superstitions and odd activities that sports people do. There was a certain tennis player who almost had to retire because of her OCD, her obsessive behaviours, wasn't it? I can't remember her name.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was, but I remember the story.
But at what point does that become? Does a superstition become a habit? Become an obsession? Is that OCD to start with, or does it become OCD, or where does that line get drawn? It's interesting.
I imagine in sports, because there's you're obviously controlling. You've got to be very in control of your body, and your things like weight, boxing, certainly things like weight. I would imagine that kind of lends itself to obsessive behaviour.
Yeah,
or it can. Yeah, if you've already got that underlying habit, that underlying tendency, then it would. I would imagine it would feed it quite easily. It'd be quite easy to let it completely take over.
Yeah, I mean, I know David Beckham talks about obsessive compulsive behaviours, but that's more around the house, isn't it? He was never really in the sports.
Yeah. So
I remember reading an article years and years and years ago about an ice hockey player that one particular match, he used to chew Wrigley's chewing gum. And, you know, you could separate the paper from the foil. If you peeled really carefully, you could separate the put the paper from the foil.
And what the old sticks.
The old sticks, yeah. And what you would do is you'd peel the foil off the paper really carefully and then stick it to the side of his blade on his ice skates. And he did it this one time, just absent-mindedly, and they absolutely cruised this game.
Yeah.
And then it became a thing. But it became almost more important to him than the game itself. So much so that if he ripped the foil while doing it, he'd have to start again, and he sometimes wouldn't leave the dressing room. It became a real problem for him, so he ended up having to, which is really interesting, because that pressure to succeed, like you say, does that almost lend itself to becoming more obsessed about everything, as opposed to just being obsessed about the thing that you're very, very good at? I wonder how many other sports people have ancillary obsessive compulsive nature.
Yeah, I mean, there's always talk about sports people in general having little rituals that they get. Like footballers will talk about like getting into their kit in a certain to put everything on in a certain order.
Who's the guy who has to wear somebody else's shorts?
Oh, I don't.
There's a.
Oh, that was.
Is it
another,
a rugby player or it was an on, it was another podcast, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He has to wear. He has to try on an opposition pair player's shorts before a match.
It might. It's rugby or is American
it rugby,
football.
It
or
might
something.
Be American football. That's or it might be basketball. I don't know. We're rambling. We're rambling already. But it's interesting, and sometimes it can be. Sometimes it, in the media, it can be passed off as, oh, lols, look at him, you know, and I think sometimes it can be quite jovial. I think if people see it themselves as, you know, if people aren't too bothered by it,
yeah,
I think you can, you know, the person in question can make light of it, and then we can. But the problem is that often masks something more sinister underneath, more troublesome for that particular person. They could be going through absolute, you know, purgatory, and we don't really know.
No, and that's their thing, that it's like, well, if I do this, if I can do this right, then, and it, you know, it can, I suppose the other side of it can be, if you don't get your routine right, well, I can't even do this right, then,
yeah,
you know, what good is anything else?
That phrase in that interview that I've just read out about driving with your eyes closed or touching the ropes to ward off forces. It's an interesting phrase, that, because with intrusive thoughts, you don't necessarily, there's not necessarily a tangible end game to what happens if you don't do it. Some people get, if I don't do this, my family will die. If I don't do this, the world's going to end. If I don't do this, I will die. If I don't do this, you know, something's going to happen. Sometimes all you get is an absolute sense of impending doom. You don't know what it is that's going to be if you don't get it right, or if you don't do the thing that you're compelled to do. But if you don't, then whatever happens, it is going to be awful. And it can often change depending on where you are or what you're doing. It's basically, if I don't do this, then the worst possible outcome that can happen for me in this scenario is going to be the worst, is going to be what happened. So that's why you start becoming so much more on your guard, and you start becoming more defensive and insular, because you're always on the lookout for the worst possible thing that could happen, because then your intrusive thought just jumps onto that. It's weird.
Yeah. And yes. So at least if you've thought out the worst possible scenario, it can't take you by surprise. And often when something does happen and it's the worst possible or one of the worst possible scenarios, it does take you completely by surprise.
Yeah.
So you can't prepare for everything.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's really weird, because there's a logical part of your mind when I was really struggling with OCD, there's a logical part of your brain that goes, the worst possible scenario in this current circumstance is that a giant meteor will land on our house, and I can't do anything about that. And that your brain is going, well, of course you can't, you know, OCD won't touch any of that, because it can't screw with your thinking in a way that can make that a tangible obsession. There's just well, for me anyway. Yeah. For some people, it might be the case. I don't know. Everybody's completely different. But for me, it's often the things that are statistically unlikely, but still possible. If there's a thread that I can pull on that, then that's where it goes. But like I said in episode two, that's not been the case for a good few years. Touch wood. So, so that was interesting. I mean, obviously, Tyson Fury boxed yesterday. He discusses his, you know, his cyclical mental health issues as well. There's quite a lot of, in boxing as well. I mean, you look at Ricky Hatton when he's not fighting. It was almost as if, when he was talking in interviews after he retired, it's almost as if between fights he just shut down.
Yeah.
Emotionally. And it was almost as if the boxing was the thing that kind of recharged him, and then he put it all out there in the ring, and then just...
He seemed quite self-destructive.
Yeah.
Out, outside of in his downtime.
Yeah. Yeah, and when it, and that's when, you know, when your downtime creeps into your athlete time, that's when it becomes a problem for people like Paul Gascoigne and you know, and a lot of, you know, those footballers in the '90s like Paul Merson and Tony, what was his name? The Arsenal guy.
The Arsenal player who was done for
Tony Adams.
Yeah.
Lots of them. There's several stories of, you know, of difficult times, and I think leading on to what you're going to talk about in a second, I think it's really interesting that in recent years, rather than like with those, what were they called, the Spice Boys of Liverpool and that.
Yeah, yeah. I think they were the first sort of like super paid, super high paid players, like those players of the early 90s, the early Premier League years. Yeah. That was when the money really came into the game. Because I think before that, top flight footballers, they'd been well off, but not crazy money like it is now. And I think the start of the Premier League years, they had all this, you've got young lads with all this money thrown at them, and they didn't really have the sort of support structure, like the almost pastoral care that they have now.
That's what I was going to get to. I think they're very much more, and you're looking at some of these young kids who are coming through, who have grown up a lot around social media, and there's a lot more kind of social responsibility coming through into sort of school education and everything coming up from that. But then a lot of people coming through football academies haven't necessarily had the same kind of academic pathway as other people. So it's almost even more important that when you're going through that kind of training, that they have that kind of pastoral care that you get elsewhere. Which leads us on to the fact that we went to, it was our wedding anniversary yesterday. We've been married for 11 years, so that's lovely.
Yes.
Obviously.
All lovely.
Indeed. But we went to Goodison Park yesterday because Pam is a season ticket holder at Everton and has been for 12 years.
I think this is my 13th season.
13 years. And Everton is maybe very 14th. Much the third person in our
14th season
in our marriage.
Yes.
Aren't they? Your blue boys. So we went there because it was the first home match of the season, and it's always fun to go and do that. So but when we arrived, they have this, as is common in a lot of football grounds now, they have like a fan zone area outside where people can sort of mill about, and they have interviews and food and merchandise and stuff. And we chanced upon an interview talking about Everton's involvement in promoting mental health. So,
yeah, Everton have had a charity for a long time called Everton in the Community, which is various community projects. They have, I'm sure lots of football clubs will have a similar sort of charity, but I think Everton in the Community was one of the first. Mm. They have, there's a free school that they have, which which deals with young adults, or teenagers and young adults who've been excluded from mainstream education, or for whatever reason, mainstream education doesn't work for them. So maybe problems with, it's not necessarily people who've been excluded. Mm. It might be autism or other social difficulties as well. And they do a lot of work with like elderly and isolated people. But we missed a lot of it, but I think the interview yesterday was talking about the latest campaign. So I'll just read a little bit from the website. So Everton Football Club and its official charity, Everton in the Community, has launched a new mental health focused campaign to raise funds to build a permanent facility called the People's Place in the shadows of Goodison Park. So the area around Goodison Park, they call the Goodison Campus, because that's where the school is, that's where the community centre is.
Yeah.
I think that the head of operations used to be there, but I think that's moved down to Finch Farm now, which is the training facility for the first team, for all levels of the squads. So through a long-term fundraising drive due to start early in the new season, Everton in the community aims to develop, build and maintain a new purpose-built facility that will become a delivery site for programmes and enable signposting to other services. The new mental health facility, subject to planning permission, will be positioned within the Goodison campus, adjacent to the £1.2 million People's Hub on Spellow Lane, just 500 metres from Goodison Park. The Everton in the community has been delivering award-winning, life-changing and life-saving mental health provision across Merseyside for more than 10 years, supporting more than 5,000 individuals with bespoke programmes for those in need. So there's a lot more information on the site. I've just read a couple of paragraphs. But they finish off the article that the People's Place will offer an environment that will make people feel comfortable when talking about mental health, and most importantly, that they know help is available and no one has to suffer in silence. Mm. The People's Place campaign comes on the back of the charity's successful Home is Where the Heart Is fundraising initiative that saw Everton under-23s manager David Unsworth and his entire team of players come together with Everton in the community, the club, the fan base and the Merseyside community to raise more than £230,000 to purchase and refurbish a house to support young adults on the brink of homelessness. Mm. So I think that was quite a nice, you know, because a lot of what can be portrayed about football, especially top flight clubs, it can be quite negative, largely due to the money involved and the perceived lifestyle off the back of that.
Yeah.
I'm sure many other clubs, if not all clubs, do have similar charities and community support.
I would be. So, I mean, we live quite close to Old Trafford, and I know Man United have quite a lot of sort of similar community outreach.
Yeah.
Outreach programs, and even where I grew up, Harrogate Town conference club, they have community outreach things. You know, I mean, it's all scalable, isn't it?
Yes.
Depends. But then I suppose some of the lower league clubs, it's often a far more intrinsic part of the fabric of the club when it's grassroots and it's very small and it's community based and there's a lot of local sort of volunteer involvement. You often find that that it seems a lot closer. Although the stuff you read out seems very well thought out.
Yeah, well, I think it can quite Everton in the community, because, you know, certainly for a few more years, I know Everton are looking at having a new stadium near the Docklands, which is a far more industrial area. But where they are now, it's right in the centre of a residential district, quite a deprived area, certainly economically. And then the charity headquarters, the People's Hub, as they call it, is, you know, it's less than 500 metres from the ground, so. Mm. It is all very closely knit, and you know that it's very visible. I mean, you asked what the blue building.
It's massive. You can see it. Well, I mean, we're going on from talking about mental health in sport. I mean, it was highly publicised over the last couple of years. Clark Carlisle, former Burnley and QPR defender, talks very openly and very candidly about his own mental health issues. Sol Campbell has talked about it. Obviously, you've got
Aaron Lennon
as well. Aaron Lennon, former Everton player, was recently, last year, detained under the Mental Health Act and received treatment for a stress-related illness. And that really galvanised for people, because that came out of nowhere. And the amount of pressure and the amount of stress that sports people are under, and the discussion that came out of that was, not to turn this into a sports podcast, but it's interesting to have this discussion about you're training to be the absolute pinnacle, and then you don't make the squad, and then you don't make the team, and then you get dropped, or a manager doesn't favour you, or like there was an interview on Five Live the other day about a Chelsea player who was told that he was being put in the loan pool, and he knew as soon as he was told that he would never get a first team game, and he felt like his career was over. And if you've dedicated your entire life to that, and you feel like you're not going to, in inverted commas, get anywhere, but you're still getting paid a lot of money, that to me is a really dangerous cocktail.
Yes, and I think the temptation can be for people to go, well, you're still getting paid loads of money, what's your problem?
Yeah.
And, you know, what have you got to worry about? And I know there was, I mean, it's years ago when Stan Collymore first talked about suffering with depression, and there was someone, I can't remember who said it, but it was another former player who was saying, Stan Collymore shouldn't be depressed, he's made loads of money in his, he's making loads of money in his career. The person who can be, who should be depressed is the third, you know, the only footballers who've got the right to talk about being depressed are your 34-year-old third division player who has only been making enough to cover his mortgage, and he's coming to the end of his career and he doesn't know what he's going to do. He's the only one who's got the right to be depressed, which was kind of, I can understand where, you know, if it was purely about financial security, then okay, you could say Stan Collymore, for it, you know, can't be depressed about financial security because he's earning loads of money. Yeah. But that's not the only thing that people
that causes depression.
And sometimes there is no root cause.
No, your depression and my depression will be completely different, and it doesn't make it any less valid. If both those players got a broken arm, they get the same amount of sympathy.
Yeah.
Do you know? It's relative, and it all depends on your own circumstances.
The cartoon is in, have you tried not being depressed?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Have you tried not having a broken leg?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that was really interesting. That got us chatting on the train because we were delayed a little bit on the way home from the match because somebody on the train in front of us had a heart attack, unfortunately. So we used the, I mean, it was only like an hour or so, but we used that to have a bit of a chat about that, which was really interesting. But the main point of this episode was going to be about sleep and sleep hygiene. The main reason for that is because I love it. It's my favourite thing, sleep. I could sleep and then wake up and then smile that I've been asleep and then fall back asleep again. Whereas, Pam, you don't sleep at all, really.
No, I never have done very... I've never slept very well, but it has deteriorated markedly over the past few years. Whether that's MS-related, it could well be. It has... years ago, an MS nurse that we, it could have affected the sleep centres in your brain. There's not an awful lot. Well, it can't be. That's not something that can be fixed. But there's ways to manage it.
No, but you average a couple of hours, 3 to 4 hours a night.
About 4 hours. But something I have found is that, and I know it works differently for everyone. But when I am having, when I'm particularly struggling getting sleep and staying asleep, when my sleep's really low, having sort of 3 hours unbroken sleep is better than 5 or 6 hours broken sleep.
Yeah.
You know,
that's about getting into that deep sleep phase, though, isn't it?
I can spend sort of even 8 hours in broken sleep, and I'll probably never get out of that sort of light sleep phase before I've woken up again. Yeah. And the deep sleep, from what I understand, the deep sleep phase is what sort of recharges you.
Well, that's
you
where your batteries are recharged, isn't it? Yeah.
But, and so I never have been a good sleeper. And there's also, I find things like if I can't sleep, then I'll read. I'm really glad I like reading. Some people find like getting up and having a drink can help. Some people say it's pointless just lying there. I don't agree with that necessarily. I find that that lying and doing deep breathing, like in yoga, will refresh me.
Is that something you've come to more recently?
Yes, yeah, it is definitely. That relaxation is the next best thing to sleep. You know, you get some recharging from that, I think. But there's I've spoken about it recently in my MS nurse review, and they've talked. I can talk to a neuropsychiatrist, and I've already been warned that they will probably talk a lot about sleep hygiene.
But I mean, you have tried pretty much everything. I mean, we've been together 13 years,
yes.
and you've had a diagnosis for 11 of those years. Is it 11, 9, 10 years?
11 years. Yeah.
So this has been something that it's not something that you're coming into cold. You know, we do mindfulness body scans. We avoid. Well, let's go into the sleep hygiene options of sleep hygiene. According to the National Sleep Foundation, it's a variety of different practices and habits that are necessary to have a good nighttime sleep quality and full daytime alertness. So when they say obtaining healthy sleep is important for both physical and mental health, it can also improve productivity and overall quality of life. Everyone from children to older adults can benefit from practicing good sleep habits. So they say to improve sleep hygiene, limiting daytime naps to 30 minutes. Napping does not make up for inadequate nighttime sleep. However, a short nap of 20 to 30 minutes can help to improve mood, alertness and performance. See, I love naps.
I've got better at napping in the last few years, and I think it's because...
What, you mean just like sleeping all the time? Or?
No. I mean, I used to hate napping. I would wake up feeling really disorientated, quite often feeling quite sick, and it just... or I would feel really groggy afterwards, but I've found it's a good way to sort of recharge. And about if I'm going to have a nap in the afternoon, which I'm very lucky when I can do that, if I allow a sort of time frame of about 40 minutes, because I'll have sort of 10 minutes like settling down and whatever, and then it takes a bit of time to sort of fall asleep, and then time to wake up and be functional again, but about 20 to 30 minutes napping,
which is why we've started doing quick recharge. We've started doing body scans instead as well, which unfortunately, with the body scan often being done, I prefer to do a body scan meditation prone, lying down, as opposed to being sat up. I do often kind of sort of semi nod off at the end.
It gets turned into an impromptu nap.
But then a lot of the body scans that we follow, they often have a bell at the end, so it wakes you up anyway. But I find that quite a nice middle ground between cat napping, because I do find if I nap during the day, I don't sleep at night. And I used to be able to. My mum used to say I used to be able to fall asleep on a washing line, and I can normally if I'm all right. But what I found more recently. And I think, I don't know whether or not it could be medication related, it could just be age, it could be a number of things, but I get quite restless legs, and I know you do.
Yes, I do.
My restless legs on the scale of 1 to 10 are probably a 3 to your 8, but...
Yeah, it doesn't make it not annoying for
me. But it is proper annoying. So I find it... but the problem is, I think now, that's become a psychosomatic thing where I go to bed and I go, I'm going to have another half an hour of tossing and turning because I know I've got restless legs, and then I think about it and then I've got restless legs, and I think
when I'm not paying attention to the jerk awake thing, and I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah,
it's got a name.
Oh, that thing where you think you're falling off a cliff.
Yeah.
No, I don't tend to do that much, but if I focus on my restless legs, then they're there. If I don't, then I tend to fall asleep okay. But that's just the way my brain works. I remember as a kid, before I really knew what my OCD was, I spent days and days and days absolutely obsessed, focused on my own blinking. I couldn't get the fact that I was blinking out of my head, and I didn't sleep for days because I could feel my eyes moving, and I ended up being able to hear the tears in my eyes when I opened my eyes, and it was that was weird. But then that's just, you know, that was just me trying to work out what was going on. Now I understand that it's you know, I can I can rationalise that and say, you know, that it's just you having, you know, intrusive thoughts or manifesting that, you know, move on. But everybody goes through those phases. I mean, I remember.
Well, I'm thinking about blinking now.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, sorry about that. But it's an example. I mean, that's quite a light example. But my point being that something that bothers your sleep or disrupts your sleep then becomes the thing that stops you from sleeping because you're focusing on it. Like, I had to train myself out of looking at my clock before I went to sleep and working out how much sleep I would get if I fell asleep now.
Yeah.
So if I turn the light off, oh right, okay, I can get a good 7 hours, and then I'll turn over and I'll still be awake, and it'll be an hour later, and it's like, right, okay, if I go to sleep now, I'll get a good 6, or I'll go to sleep now, I'll get a good 4.5. And you become so focused on that.
I think that's very common
when you stop falling asleep.
If you have problems sleeping, I think that's something that's very common. And I think also with sleep, if you're not sleeping, then it becomes, I think, everyone knows that your temper's shorter when you're tired.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're sort of, you know, your pain threshold's lower, you're more sensitive to cold. And my mum used to work nights when we were kids, and she said that very often, when she was really tired, she would really, really feel the cold, be really sensitive to it. And I think it just your body's negative reactions just get heightened.
Yeah.
And that ties it to, you know, your mind's negative reactions as well. You definitely have less patience when you're tired.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've just come off a contract, which was living in Manchester and working in Sheffield, so I would get up at sort of 5:20 in the morning to drive over to Sheffield, because if I left the house at 6, I would get there for 7. If I left the house at 6:30, I wouldn't get there till 8:30, 9:15 because of the traffic.
Yeah.
So I made that trade-off of leaving early and then leaving work early as well, so I adjusted my shift pattern that way, and I would much rather do that than be stuck in the car, because that makes me uncomfortable and tired. But there was a trade-off, because there was the sleep, and yeah. I think I have to say
it did make it very difficult to plan to go anywhere during the week, because
yeah.
we wouldn't be able to get back do stuff together, able to get back in time for you to
have a decent amount of rest.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think those 3 years have permanently, well, not permanently, but long term, changed the way my sleep patterns worked. And now, because I'm deliberately having a couple of weeks off, I think I'm getting back into a natural cycle of sleep, which is nice, because I certainly feel a lot more rested.
Yeah.
But moving on for the sleep hygiene examples. So we've said limit daytime naps, avoid stimulants such as caffeine and nicotine close to bedtime. When it comes to alcohol, moderation is key. Thank you. while alcohol is well known to help you fall asleep faster, too much close to bedtime can disrupt the sleep in the second half of the night as the body begins to process the alcohol. So you can't, basically your liver wakes you up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, if we've gone out and we've had a bit of a heavy night, I don't feel like I've slept. I just feel like I've not been awake.
Yeah,
it doesn't feel like sleep, because you do feel, and I suppose that's your body processing the alcohol, isn't it?
Yeah, it's. Although, I mean, there's things like mitigating that, like plenty of water before you go to bed, and then although then you'll wake up needing the loo, but yeah, that's a different thing.
I'm 42. I wake up needing the loo. Anyway, so
those vitamin tablets. You know, the sports.
Oh, like Barocca, yeah.
Yeah, or like the electrolyte ones that you use for when you're training.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Those rehydration drinks.
Yeah.
Having one of those before bed, that can help.
Yeah, it can.
Not that necessarily helps with your sleep, but it can make you more comfortable.
More comfortable, yeah. And then exercising, you've just touched on that, to promote good quality sleep. As little as 10 minutes of aerobic exercise, such as walking or cycling, can drastically improve nighttime sleep quality. For the best night's sleep, people should avoid strenuous workouts close to bedtime. Well, that's just because it gets you all your adrenaline going, isn't it?
Yeah.
However, the effect of intense nighttime exercise on sleep differs from person to person, so find out what works best for you. I mean, I've been going to mixed martial arts for a bit, on and off. I mean, I had to have a bit of a break when I had my appendix out, and I injured myself a couple of months ago. I don't go as often as I'd like to, but I've also started running again, which I'm really enjoying. Although looking out the window at the moment, it's absolutely throwing it down, and I was planning to go after recording this, but I'll just put my cagoule on and go out anyway. But I do definitely feel better if I've been exercising regularly. I do definitely feel a lot more alert and a lot sharper. And if I feel alert and sharp, I don't get taken by surprise by, you know, any dips in my mental health as much as I would do if I haven't been exercising a lot. If I've been very sedentary for a good week or so, I can definitely feel the kind of mean level of emotional resilience is lower, definitely. Yeah. Plus it's a proper boss when you do a little PB, or you know, you run a little bit longer or a little bit further than you did the day before or whatever. It's a goal. It's nice. And obviously that's not, you know, not everybody can do that, but it's about finding what works for you. Steering clear of food that can be disruptive right before sleep.
Oh, sorry, I'm yawning again.
see that, but contagious yawning. There was an article, a questionnaire about yawning, and they had just put the word yawn on the computer screen in big letters, and they asked you to be honest as to whether or not it made you yawn, and every time it would just make me yawn. And the problem is as well that SSRIs like Prozac and sertraline and other antidepressants in that group, chronic yawning is a side effect. It's not super common, but it's something that's affected me since I started taking Prozac years and years ago. I've always been a yawn, and it's difficult because you know, when you're doing a podcast and you yawn, it's not because I'm tired, it's just because I'm yawning.
You yawn a lot on the phone.
I do yawn, yeah. When I'm talking on the phone, I will yawn loads. It's really weird.
Yeah.
Interesting, anyway. Steer clear of food. Heavy or rich foods, fatty or fried meals, spicy dishes, citrus fruits or carbonated drinks can trigger indigestion. So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. So basically, don't go out, have 10 pints and then a kebab, because basically you're not going to sleep. You're going to be unconscious and basically a processing factory. So you won't feel, which is probably why hangovers are worse, you know. Well, hangovers are bad anyway, but hangovers can be worse when you've eaten as well.
Yeah, I think, yes, because there's people, and I suppose it depends what you've eaten. Hmm. I think something like having some toast and a cup of tea or herbal tea or something, or some water.
All right, Grandad.
After that, no, that's going to do you more good than having a can of Coke and
sausage
a curry.
And chips, yeah. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, it's nice, though, isn't it? and then ensuring adequate exposure to natural light. Now, obviously, in the last few weeks, it's been nice because we've had lots of really good weather. So the vitamin D batteries have been recharged a bit. But it's particularly important for individuals who may not venture outside frequently. You know, exposure to sunlight during the day as well as darkness at night can help to maintain a healthy sleep-wake cycle, so your kind of circadian rhythms work. But then there's a lot of evidence to suggest that we absolutely abuse our circadian rhythms because of our kind of work cycle. You know, we when the clocks go back, we get up early, we get up in the dark because the work cycle is more important than the sleep cycle. So we don't sleep in long, because you would naturally, as an animal, sleep in longer in the winter.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. And, you know, I wonder, you know, we talked about this in an earlier episode about how areas where you get more natural sunlight closer to the equator, that instances of MS are notably fewer.
Yeah, I mean, there's a definite... I've certainly not read anything about whether it's been definitive. They've not managed to absolutely define what the link is, but there's a definite link between vitamin D levels and a lot of chronic autoimmune disease. So sunlight will obviously play a massive part in that.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's the vitamin D supplements that you can take.
Those sprays.
There's a spray, you can get tablets. Sometimes you'll be, I know that people have been prescribed vitamin D. Apparently the tablets are massive, really difficult to swallow. But you can buy lots of, health food shops sell lots of different kinds of vitamin D supplements. Something that does help a lot is melatonin. Although it's quite difficult to get in the UK. I'm not quite sure why. I haven't researched why, but I just know that it's quite difficult to get. Mm. But melatonin is something that you naturally produce when you're asleep. Mm. So taking it as a supplement will kind of re-trigger
it.
In a similar way to, I mean, I've only had, it was years and years ago, had sleeping tablets on rare occasions. And the idea behind prescribing those is because you can't take them on consecutive days, and I would only get like 7 tablets in a prescription. But the idea behind it being you take a tablet and it will knock you out for at least 4 hours, but then you've had 4 or 5 hours sleep, and it was not proper sleep, it was unconsciousness, really, because it was sleep wake. In my perception. But then you'd go about your normal day, and then by the end of the day you'd be naturally, your brain would be getting ready to sleep. And if you'd have a few cycles where you'd take one, say every 3 days, then that can be enough to sort of kickstart your sleep cycle.
The problem with those is, and
it didn't really do that for me, because as soon as I stopped taking them, I was back to the bad, and I didn't feel particularly well rested after it. Because, like I say, it was just out completely. And
anecdotally, they're misprescribed as well. I've seen them misprescribed many times, where you don't get the ancillary education about why you're taking them and why you take them every few days rather than every day, and they're just given to people to take every day, and then all you're doing is you're just forming a habit, and the sleep cycle is damaged even further, which is a shame. But the next thing on the list is establishing a regular relaxing bedtime routine. A regular nightly routine helps the body recognise that it's bedtime. This could include taking a warm shower or bath, reading a book, or light stretches. I like this bit, though. When possible, try to avoid emotionally upsetting conversations and activities before attempting to sleep. Right, so try not to have an argument just before bedtime. We listen to podcasts quite a lot. We tend to put, often like No Such Thing as a Fish, but there's a couple of other podcasts. There's a podcast we listen to which does have episodes about serial killers on, which we've left running while we've been asleep, and that's led to a couple of interesting dream sequences. I often find, if I'm struggling to sleep, I find it much easier to go to sleep if I've got something to ignore. But it needs to be something that I'm familiar with. Mm. So if there's a noise outside, like a party or whatever, I can't ignore that because I don't really know the limits of that. I don't know what's coming next. I don't know so my brain is going, well, what's going to happen here? Whereas if it's an audiobook that I've heard 10 times before, it's a noise that my brain can kind of focus on, and then I'm gone, it. I'm out, and which is really interesting.
I know years and years ago, there was... A flat down the road from where I was living was having a party that went on Wednesday, and it was so noisy. It must have only been a few houses away. It was so noisy, and I was dreaming about alien invasions. And I woke up from this really vivid dream, and the noise was still going on. And it was some kind. It must have been a bass or that I yeah. could hear, and it had worked its way into my dream. But yeah, that was very strange. But it was obviously a noise that I didn't recognise as being like routine.
And then
it was an odd situation.
Yeah, so I mean, we do have a regular routine. Especially because I was getting up early at the same time every day for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. We'd have to have a regular routine because otherwise neither of us would get any sleep. But then it says here, making sure that the sleep environment is pleasant. So mattress and pillow should be comfortable, fine. The bedroom should be cool between 60 and 67 degrees. Well, it hasn't been over the last couple of weeks. It's been ridiculous. For optimal sleep, bright light from lamps, cell phones and TV screens can make it difficult to fall asleep, so turn those off or adjust them when possible. I mean, I have like the blue light filter turned on my phone after 9 o'clock anyway, but I do try not to look at it when I can. I've tried to kind of cut down on my social media in the last couple of weeks anyway, but trying not to look at your phone because it's just endlessly scrolling through stuff, and then that gets you thinking about things, and especially if you you find an article about a serial killer just before you go to sleep. Or something, consider using blackout curtains. We've just got some actually a few months ago. That's made a massive difference because we've got there's a street light directly opposite, which they've changed the bulb on in the last year, and it is just
super bright. Donkey. Or it seems super bright at night.
It's much brighter than it used to
and
be.
And also the sun, the way the sun travels across the sky. And it's quite a big window.
The bedroom window directly is north facing, isn't it? Yeah, so we got a lot of that from.
Yeah, it used to be when we just had linen curtains. Yeah, it was super bright, and you were awake when the sun was up, whether you wanted to be or not. Blackout curtains, definitely a good investment.
But this last bit, consider using blackout curtains, eye shades, earplugs, white noise machines, humidifiers, fans, and other devices that can make the bedroom more relaxing. That sounds like you'd be inside a washing machine. Like, imagine all that noise.
Yeah.
But then, funnily enough, we do have a dehumidifier next door because we often put like the laundry out next door in the spare room, so we have a dehumidifier just to keep the damp under control. I find that through the wall, that's kind of like a white noise. I find that quite, because it's been there for so long.
Yeah.
I find that quite comforting.
Yeah.
That keeps me quite settled, which is nice.
I do have an eye mask, but I find that it tends to it doesn't always stay on in the night.
I remember you had an eye mask on once and you woke up because it was strangling you. Because you kind of shuffled around and moved your head around so much it had gone around your neck.
Yeah, or I wake up and I've pushed, I've obviously felt something on my face in my sleep and pushed it up to the top of my head. Or pushed it sideways so it's in the other way. So, yeah, that's not always helpful if you're going to be moving around. But, yeah, blackout curtains, I would highly recommend.
Yeah. It says here, what are the signs of poor sleep hygiene? Frequent sleep disturbances and daytime sleepiness are the most telling signs of poor sleep hygiene. It's really weird. About 2 months ago, at 2 o'clock or between half one and half two, every day I'd have to go for a walk for 5 minutes because I was literally nodding off at my desk.
Yeah.
And I was eating healthily.
Yeah.
I wasn't drinking as much coffee. So there wasn't that big peak and trough.
Yeah,
it's just weird. It's so weird.
I noticed that improved for me when I stopped having carb-heavy lunches. I think, have it... Because a jacket potato and cheese or something is quite a nice lunch to have. But a couple of hours after, you will hit that dip when you... you've digested it all and your body goes, oh, nap now. And, everyone says it, have a big meal, just have a little sleep now.
Yeah, well, it's like the Spanish siesta, isn't it? Yeah.
But Christmas dinner, when I was a kid, I never understood why all the grown-ups fell asleep after dinner.
Well, you were still full of chocolate.
Yeah.
And you had all the toys to play with
and
as well.
All the sweets to eat. Only day of the year when I could get away with just eating sweets I wanted.
Yeah, absolutely.
But now... Totally understand it. Big roast dinner, little nap.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, hopefully, thanks to the National Sleep Foundation, there's some good information about sleep hygiene there. And obviously, you know, it's not explicit in that documentation, but that all has a massive effect on your mental health. Poor sleep, you know, because you if you're tired, you're grumpy. For me, certainly, if I'm tired, if I've had 2 days of bad sleep, I can certainly feel that I need to be very, very vigilant about keeping the black dog at bay, because being tired and makes me emotional. Being emotional makes me depressed, and then that can go downhill very, very quickly.
If I've struggled to stay asleep for a few hours, and I've been having very broken sleep, I'm definitely more sensitive and emotional. I find it much more difficult to cope with little things.
Yeah.
And that, you know, short tempered.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you end up feeling worse because
you've been ratty with people.
Yeah, and then you get cross with yourself, and it just perpetuates.
Yeah, absolutely.
Itself.
But what we'll do on the links as well is I'll post a link to this Sleep Foundation website and a couple of other sleep hygiene links as well. But what I'll also do is I'll post a link to a body scan meditation. It's just a simple. It can be anything from 10 to 30 minutes, depending on which one you choose. So I'll pick one somewhere in the middle. But it's just a meditation that I often use. If I'm feeling a little bit anxious, we do it often, don't we?
Yeah.
If we're just feeling a little bit antsy or can't settle, a body scan meditation is just a superb brain training exercise just to get yourself into that present moment self-awareness that just takes that edge off and can not necessarily make you fall asleep, because that's not what it's for, but it can quieten the mind. It can help you to be present and less focused on the noise and anxiety of daily life, which can then promote a general sense of relaxation, which can then aid sleep.
I find it very, very useful if I can't sleep, if I've accepted that I'm probably not going to get to sleep anytime soon. I think I find doing the body scan meditation, not necessarily listening to it, but
well, you've done just, it often enough
yeah,
to know how to
just
do it,
running through that body scan will get me into a more restful state, so I'm at least getting relaxation, which I said I think it can be the next best thing to help recharge you.
Absolutely. So with that, we'll round off today's episode. One thing to say, next week we're going to be, hopefully either next week or the week after, we're going to be doing one. We've touched on it today, but we're going to be doing one about exercise and mental health. I'm hoping to try and get an interview with a couple of people regarding their experiences of using exercise in order to maintain good and positive mental health. If you've got any comments or questions or stories or opinions about exercise and mental health, I'd really like to hear from you, because it's a very interesting topic, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that obviously it is good for promoting good mental health, but also there's different ways of doing it. There's a few different news stories about people who have conquered their own personal demons through exercise, through setting challenges. Do you find having a goal useful, or do you find that you put too much pressure on yourself? That kind of thing. If you've got any questions about that or comments about that, I'd love to hear from you. So podcast@thinkinghabits.co.uk, or get us on the socials at Thinking Habits, and on Facebook at Thinking Habits Pod. And any other questions or queries or comments, obviously more than welcome. So with that, we'll finish for today, and we'll round off by the usual keep talking, and if you need to talk, you know where we are.
Bye.
Bye.